Welcome to all of you this afternoon. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I want to welcome you to our event today with Major General Douglas Stone, who has been Deputy Commanding General for Detainee Operations with the Multinational Forces Iraq. As some of you know, USIP has long been concerned with rule of law issues, and one of the USIP doctrines on rule of law is that you've got to build up a complete spectrum of capabilities from intelligence to incarceration, including all the steps in between. You can't do just police or just corrections. You have to do the whole spectrum of things. But we've had relatively few opportunities over the years to look at what Multinational Forces Iraq calls detainee operations. The correction side, like everybody else on Earth, I guess, we have tended to ignore the correction side more than our own doctrine tells us we should. And so it's a particular pleasure to welcome the General, who tells me that in addition to his eminent qualifications, which you have in his bio, that he is also has a civilian existence, very much so, in fact, as a software executive. He has a number of master's degrees, including one in business from Stanford and a degree in public administration from USC. So he comes at this with a very broad background and has clearly contributed something in Iraq that is very important and that needs some attention. So we're looking forward to hearing from you, General. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you. Let me start by
I think the cameras are going to prefer if you come up here, General, if you don't mind. Yeah.
They can't turn?
There's the microphones up here. Hey, I'm afraid public affairs dictates our very...
Is there other questions of yours?
If we can, sure. It would be easier. Thank you.
Well, let me start by being cantankerous. I don't view this job, and haven't since I got there, as corrections. Corrections is a byproduct of a system that allows you to have a sentence where you have evidence, and somebody who goes to the prestigious schools like Yale tries you before a court, and regardless of how that court may look, and some are different, certainly the Iraqis one is different, you're found guilty, and then you're offered a sentence, and that sentence is then adjudicated in a prison. And the prison then treats you in one of two different ways. Either you're, in a rehabilitation program, which are sadly lacking as best I can tell, or you are there for retribution, which appears to be the norm. Retribution then is carried out in lots of ways, and in the more extreme manner, it's often torture. So we don't do prisons. Regrettably, our Iraqis are not here. They would tell you, the concept of detention carries with it various different kinds of roles, and certainly prisons are different. There are Iraqi prisons, and they are very different than civilian internment, which is what I manage. They are clearly kept in a condition where they're not allowed to leave, and that's, of course, where the concept of a prison comes in. And I don't take offense to anybody who refers to detention facilities as a prison. I simply want to be clear that they are civilian internment. I would also strongly agree in the concept of counterinsurgency warfare that courts, cops, and corrections are an absolute necessary requirement for the civil society to be able to handle its own cultural problems in its own appropriate manner. And part of what U.S. forces do and are doing in great manner in areas where we're getting significant help, and I would include in that the more difficult areas like Al Anbar, that it is when those local citizens jump in and take on a more rigorous responsibility for those three functions, courts, cops, and corrections, that you actually see the civil society become civil. I had no particular opening comments, but as they say, I'm a general, and so I can speak at a drop of a hat. Let me start with just a couple, and then you need to tell me how long. You think 5, 6, 7, 10?
10.
Okay. Detention has had, as you know, a rather dismal record in Iraq. It is a product, I think, in large part, about this clarity about the war and the purpose of detention. Most assuredly, there are issues associated with the policy, aslan legal. And on top of the confusion about the mission, it became a confusion about just exactly these issues. Well, what do you do if you're collecting information? And if you're not collecting it in a manner that you need it, then most assuredly the guy that's in there in your corrections facility is going to give it to you. I might add that not only do we do detention, but we also handle more than 30,000 interrogations. So all of that responsibility in Iraq was mine. And there's probably nothing more that I monitored every day than were all those interrogations. I don't think there's anybody in this room who has... Hey, how you doing? Good to see you. Yeah, good to see you. It's unlikely that anybody here has had more one-on-one time with Al-Qaeda than I. There are maybe some, I'm not sure. But unless you've talked to more than 2,000, I would put you in the Bush League group. I would also indicate that I've talked to the 17-year-olds who claim to be in that organization and then work their way through the ranks. So detention is far beyond just care and custody. It is far beyond the basic precept of corrections. It goes to, I think, not just how do we engage in this kind of a ideological engagement, war, if you want to use the right word, but it goes to the question of morality and ethics, our own particular values, our national values, our individual values. It has to do a lot with engagement with people, not only one-on-one, but people as people themselves, their own culture. It draws into a daily question about your own ethnocentric perspectives, which are, if you're looking for perhaps one of the greatest roadblocks to doing this business well, it's just that. Ethnocentricity is, if not the greatest stumbling block to being successful, it's certainly in the top list of things. Because it means that you don't fully appreciate or understand faith or the collective nature of the society, the cultural component, the concept of governance, the social compact upon which the individuals were brought in the first place. It calls to question what we do more than what we say, and that's hard because many people here are of words and they say, well, you know, I said this, but the reality is in the hardcore business of doing things, it is only the things that you do that really matter. It is only the actions that you take that really have any particular value. And so saying things are nice, but doing things is what matters. It draws into question what's war fighting versus what is war winning. And I would argue that there's a difference. It raises questions about visibility, transparency, definition of the enemy. What is the enemy and why are they fighting? And how much do you really know about who they are? Therefore, how much would you really know if you were beating them? And if you had created a situation in detention that was actually aiding and abetting the enemy, for creating the situation precisely what it is that they wanted, were you doing your war fighting or your war winning mission? Were you doing the right thing relative to the local society? Were you securing the local population at the risk of not securing the outside one? It calls into question the nature of the security threat, not just locally, but regionally, and at a level that only becomes clear after you spend a lot of time in multiple countries on a global basis. The rule of law was mentioned, and it clearly bumbles across the concept of rule of law in very important definitional ways. It raises the question, what does a local tribal justice mean relative to your concept, whatever that might be, of rule of law. It ultimately begins to ask some questions if you look at it in the greater nature, and I would assume that you're not here all because you think something's happening in Iraq and therefore it would never happen again. I would hope you're here because you have a sense that something else is moving, something else has happened, that some of you may know something about what's going on in Afghanistan or Indonesia or Somalia or 30 some other countries that we could play pin the tail on if you wanted to. Because political Islam is a very real concept, and the concept of violent Islamists, and by that I don't mean, because there's somebody here from the press, I want to be very clear. Islamist has a very precise definition. Okay, it does not mean Islam. Like, there's nobody here who has the greatest regard for Islam than I. I pray with Muslims, I engage with them, I read the Quran daily. Nobody does that more than I. So Islamist refers to somebody who practices a very precise, violent, interpreted form of Islam that is not even correctly defined as fundamentalist. I have a lot of very good, close fundamentalist friends who I don't think go out and kill innocents on a day-to-day basis and justify it by their belief structure. Calls into question, if you don't counter that in the course of detention, what are you doing about the expanding efforts of that greater political ideological movement? And ultimately, it means that you have to understand the origins of what it has to say to us about who we are as a people and where we want to be. I'd like to go on at great length and talk to you about a number of specifics, and I will, because I'd rather tease out through your questions what it is that you're interested in, and I'll see if I can't lace through it. But let me just sort of close by ensuring you understand that when I got there, as General Petraeus has been quite public in saying, the riots were extreme enough that within the first couple weeks, at least 10,000 were rioting, and we were, at the first time that at least anybody could remember in some time, positioned to use lethal force on a great number of detainees. The only reason that you can justify doing that is if you think you're going to be overrun, and we thought we were. So the great guys who were manning the guards that night stood their ground. We made the choice. Could you pass that water, please? Made the choice not because we were ordered to, but because, thank you. Because we knew it was the right thing to do in terms of the concept of the other things we had to do to not use that force. And you may find some interesting statistics of note. From the period that I took over to the time the programs got in place and started, we shot about 17,000 non-lethal rounds at detainees to hold them in a disciplined fashion one way or the other. After these programs have come in, and then you have to add another 2 or 3 months on top of that, there have been no more than 1,000 rounds shot. And that's a rather striking difference, given that the numbers soared to nearly 26,000 through this period. In the last 26 weeks, there's not been one violent detainee-on-detainee action in any theater internment facility in Iraq. There have not been any tunnels. Tunneling to get out. In sharp contrast to that, there have been nearly 70,000 families visiting detainees. More than 10,000 engaged in educational, Iraqi Minister of Education approved education systems. There have been at least 9 public release ceremonies. But daily detainees are released. But at those 9, we just use the number of 300 because it's sort of how we match, press that would equal about half of this room, but with 30 or 40 more cameras from all over Pan-America, Pan-Arab and U.S. followed it. They are then allowed, should the detainee decide, and the releasee now decide, to sit down and talk with any one of them, and they do. So you may find it interesting that more than 3,000 releasees. These are detainees who were 20 minutes before were under our care and custody, and then 20 minutes later released, talked to reporters. And some of the organizations that were represented here always have the same question. Tell me about the torture. We watched one very responsible organization ask that question 38 times, 9 times. So 270 times in different detainees they asked, tell me about the torture. The detainee never said they got torture, and it got to the point where the guy got tired of hearing he got his high school education while he was in detention. So it is a different place, and it is one that I think General Petraeus is comfortable with. The warfighters have every reason to be concerned about. I always have to put and feel the need to put a bona fide out there. I've been to 78 memorial services for Marines, and not one of us would knowingly release somebody that would hurt another Marine or soldier. Just wouldn't do it. So by that being said, you cannot hold individuals without the belief that they're an imperative security risk. It's just not the way that I think warfighters fight. I don't think it's the way you win a counterinsurgency war. And so there have to be releases. In general, over the course of the period, the warfighters would prefer to detain and prefer there be no release. And that's understandable. I, on the other hand, believe you need to release as many as quick as you can who are no longer an imperative security risk, while sending them through the process that allows them to understand a rule of law, help us understand the engagement, the issues on hand, to receive some sort of separation between who are the most extreme and who are endangering the population, both on the inside of the theater internment facility as well as on the outside. And these are programs that we put in place, and I don't know that we can hand that out. We'd have to kind of check, but General Petraeus asked the other day, listen, I would like a summary of what you've done. And so we wrote sort of a couple pages of, here are the basic principles that we developed, some of the basic concepts. And then we listed more than 100 separate programs that are unique. The women's program, for example, had not been started before. The family advocacy program, enduring threat board, VOTEC program. So they're not, just how I spent my summer. These are meaningful, in some cases quite expensive, the Ramadi and the Taji Theater Internment Facility. So we could reference some of that. But with that, let me stop and just tell you, it's yours for the questions. My most recent exposure to questions in front of the press was 2 days ago, I guess, with the DOD or the Pentagon Press Corps. They all looked just like you did, like, oh, I said, why am I here? And the first one had 2 questions, and then somewhere in the middle of it, Matt, Major Morgan's back there, every single individual had a hand up. And so please understand, I don't know how to referee hands if they all go up, so you'll just have to help me. I'm just going to go left, right, left, right.
I get to referee.
You get to do it. Good, okay.
But first, General, if you don't mind, I'd like to arrange the release of these captives in that corner and urge them to come round and take some of the empty seats that are available. There are some in the back, too. Those who would like to ask questions, because we do have the cameras and we are recording, if you can come up to the microphone here, it would be very helpful. Come, you'll get there. We're a little tight today, I apologize for that. Bob, can you introduce yourself and ask you a question?
General, my name is Bob Ferrito. I work here at the Institute. I've got 2 questions on the same subject. How many people in your population of detainees are irreconcilable or incorrigible, and how do you intend to deal with these people in the short term but also in the long run?
That was 2 questions.
It was one,
yeah. A fully loaded one. Well, the simple answer is I don't exactly know. The process to determine the irreconcilability, which we have changed, by the way. The psychologists that work for us made some very interesting points. They said, General Stone, you happen to be irreconcilable on some matters. I know this. And I said, yeah, but so irreconcilability in and of itself is not a reason to keep somebody. So we changed it to enduring threat. And so the enduring threat board is what we now do. You'll have to show me the definition of an enduring threat, and then I'll give you the precise answer to your question. But the simple answer is it was judgment that got these guys detained. In some cases, there is what you might in your parlance use as evidence, an evidentiary trail that might, in a court of law, prove what some would say would just be terrible. Let's lock these guys up. I mean, I have detainees who have done the most atrocious acts that you can imagine, and everybody knows they've done it, but we have no evidence on it. They can describe it. We saw that it happened, but we just don't have the evidence of it, up to some terrible, terrible things. Would they become a threat to the United States? Are they a threat to the Iraqis? Are they a threat strictly to their tribe, to their region? Are they an enduring threat to their tribe, but are they an enduring threat to the United States? So rather than dazz you with all of the problems that you might go through if you're in my position trying to ask that very difficult question over the course of the year with no guidance on what that definition is, what I've come down to is just this simple. The warfighters and increasingly the Iraqis, and we're working very hard to include them in this judgment process, these panels that exist, have to have a sense about them as to what this means. What does an irreconcilable threat to, and then you have to fill it in, my country, the region, the United States, what is that? And how would you know it if you really saw it? And then once they start that process, they debate and they engage and then they vote. Now, I will tell you, for the period of time that I was there, I made one simple matter. If the individual was justifiably re-engaged in counterinsurgent activity that we could justify theater-level internment, and they went out and they came back, of which we have had now with about 10,000 releases, about 40. Of those 40, not all of them fall in that category. Some have simply been, they landed at the Iraqi police station, the Iraqi police says, I don't like this guy, I don't like his father, I don't like anything about him, they put him on the thing and send him back. So you have to parse out even what I just said. But if they were going back to it, for me, for the period of time that our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines are on the ground, that became a good categorization. Now, there are 20,000 and dropping in detention. In principle, as a matter of course, the boards that are made up of the core members are viewing that about 46%, maybe 50% ought to be released, then about one-third ought to be still detained. If they are voted for further detention, we then put them through this different process, the Enduring Threat Board, which is adapting all the time, new checklists, new ways of thinking, including different cultural pieces, psychologists, doing anything we can, because, again, if somebody here has the book, but in fact, if you have the book on detention, just hand it over, because it would save a lot of the work that we've been trying to do, but there's nothing that exists. And I pride myself on being a researcher, and I have not found anything except for, you know, tidbits out of Greek classics, tidbits out of, you know, T.E. Lawrence, tidbits out of Coin Manual, etc., that you can stream and net together. This is one of the more difficult ones. But we have come up today with a number that is just under about 100 that we would say are really in that category as we are concerned about. Now, our good ambassador from Iraq, the Iraqis themselves may sit in this and they may say, you just missed 2,000. And then I'll say, okay, well, let's define what you mean by 2,000, and then let's get some other viewpoint from Iraq to come in, and they'll say, you missed 2,000, it's that 2,000, not this 2,000. So we're going to have to deal with this next, but I want to give you an order of magnitude. 100 or 2 that we have deep concerns about that do not have evidence on them to put them through the Iraqi court system. Now, I want to make sure you understand, if they have evidence, they go to the Iraqi court system. And about 10% do, and we get about a 71% rate of conviction, which for the lawyers and the family here are is very high, because there's no plea bargaining. And they've said to me, I love doing the bloggers, and I know I've got a couple of you that monitor them, but I love the bloggers. Well, you know, it's just ridiculous, because in the United States, you get 95%, like 99% commission rate. I said, it's all plea bargaining. They're all plea bargaining. If you did the real plea bargaining, the lawyers tell me the number might not even get past 10% that would really get through the courts. So this is a pretty high rate of people looking at it. Certainly these guys fall into that, and some of them have gone into and have been a part of that process and are up into the douche or other prison system where we monitor them. Because by my standards and by those that we sort of coalesce around, they are deeply concerning and would plan for and or have planned to try to come back over. But you've hit on a very important rule of law issue, one for which there was only judgment, and as best I can tell, I mean, I have not, I pride myself, I suspect, more on breaking the rules than I do following them, so the reality is I'm not a good judge of the law, the legal system, because it just seems to me it's who you buy that gets you out, or how you argue the argument. What we look at very clearly is who is it and how is it that this and threat may come back to deeply hurt the society of Iraq or the society of the U.S. or at some level the region. And we have individuals for whom they are enduring threats, but it's a small number. And now, the end game on this, I think, and I don't know, as you know, it's known as the Status of the Force Agreement, but it's really whatever is or is not the replacement for Chapter 7, UN Security Council resolution, has to be debated. I mean, we went to Iraq to help with sovereignty, and sovereignty will be where it will end. And we're in that process of moving sovereignty. Detention is a clear component of that. When do you take the citizens that are a part of Iraq, and we only have 220 non-Iraqi citizens, these are 220 third country nationals, everybody else is an Iraqi, period. One of the 14 detainee legends. Usually I start with that. How many are from another country do you think in detention? And the norm is this group like this would guess about 2,000 or 5,000, but it is only 200. Except for those 200, they're all Iraqis. So the Iraqis are going to have to decide. They're going to have to sit ultimately and decide this guy or this individual is an enduring threat, and then they stay. And I think that we will, as all good people do, sit and argue vehemently that some of these guys should not be allowed to get out. What if there's no rule on the books? What if there's no law that you can prove that they violated, but yet you know by the behavior and the statements and everything else, so you know by this psychotic behavior, you just know, then that's going to have to be dealt with by two people sitting down and talking about it. And that doesn't feel very good for a lot of people, particularly in the room right now. They're saying, it's just not clear. It just doesn't make sense. Well, come work in detention, because there is no clarity in detention. These are all value judgments. By the way, I know he's going to push me on to another question, but I think it's important to think about one question. People early on said, that's not democratic. They would say, it's just not the legal system. And what I would, and finally came down to, is arguing that it makes a lot less import what the form of government is. Iraqis have a form of government. The cultural and religious orientation may be distasteful to Americans because church and state are one and the same. But at the end of the day, it exists. Excuse me. It's profoundly there. And so an argument about a dictatorship or a democracy or whatever almost doesn't make as much difference as the question about how that politic embodies consensus or community, about legitimacy, organization, effectiveness, stability. Those are the fundamental questions. And so how they come about, what they come about, isn't going to be codified today. And that's exactly the answer to the enduring threat question that you just asked. How we come about in a way. Our judgment is made up by individuals who have done their very best, and we will include and we'll do other layering. If you've ever seen my chart, it is about continuous evaluation and assessment, continuous, constant, because people change, situations change on the ground, etc., but the definition also changes. And so that has to be, until the last moment when it's turned over to the Iraqis, that has to be the process. And my personal belief is the Iraqis are going to pick that up and go right straight through and do the same thing. Now, what if the wrong guy gets released? What if that happens? There's altogether another rule of law that they have to weave their way through to get out. And it doesn't necessarily mean they'll get out and be able to jump on a plane and come to our country. So there's lots and lots of ways in which these issues get resolved and get dealt with. But I wish I could give you a clean answer. You asked one of the more tougher questions, and actually one of the ones that I do not have a real crisp answer to, because it goes to cultural process. Hard to deal with and unsatisfying to all those engineers in the group who say, it just doesn't add up.
Please. No way.
It's not going to bother me if you're walking by.
Hi, General. Thanks for coming.
Does this thing work?
Yes,
okay. Sure. My name is Mike Kellerman. I'm with Press TV. I think you've established there are approximately 20,000 in detention. Is that correct, sir?
The number is dropping down through
20,000. Right now, sir, that's 20,000? Something like that?
Wave at me. It was 21 and dropping through 20.
Just under 21,000.
Okay. Yeah. How many facilities are they in?
They are in Buka and Cropper.
So two facilities. Okay, they're getting trials, you say 10% go to court, most of them plea bargain out, am I incorrect in saying that?
No, there's no plea bargaining in their system. Their system is a French process with the judicial system.
What are they charged with, and do they go, how many go to trial?
Okay, which are you talking about, the 20,000 or the 10,000?
The detainees you're responsible for.
The detainees are not charged formally unless they have evidence. They are, however, in a judgment basis found as an imperative security risk under the UN Security Council resolution and charter, which is the mandate offered to U.S. forces by the government of Iraq to take a civilian internee out of the theater of war and to hold them under international law, not human rights law, international law, and to hold them until the conditions are that they are no longer an imperative security risk.
Okay, what do you say to those who say that your re-education is brainwashing, much like the communist re-education camps of the Vietnam War from the North? It sounds to me like you're imposing maybe some sort of Western culture on these folks who really are not going to accept this. So,
Okay, there's four errors in the statement. Number one, we don't say re-education. Never have. Let's not even name that. Second of all, it's voluntary. If they don't want to go, they don't go.
Hmm.
They're not made to. It doesn't make any difference if they do or they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Not to us, anyway. Third of all, the communists in the situation didn't do re-education. If you know your history, go back and take a look at it. We got Korean War vets, I'll tell you.
Okay, I'm using an analogy, but you get
it. Yeah, no, that's okay. But you can't brainwash, you can't do that. It's just a different process. And because I have so many psychiatrists and counselors working for us, I'll tell you that. But let's talk about what it is so that we can get that on the table.
Okay.
In this culture, the Quran and the trilogy, the Quran, Hadith, and the Surah, and I'm just shortening it, are a part of the way the culture lives. In fact, at one extreme, the entire set of rules, including Sharia law, are all embedded in that. That is the wisdom of Muhammad. It was the way to unite all the tribes. So to take civic behavior and extract it from that, or to try to teach what I don't actually think is taught in U.S. schools anymore, called civics, would just be patently ridiculous. It wouldn't even make sense. So what happens is civic behavior is taught in a non-teaching basis, but in a discussion group, where after the detainee is able to read, and it's important that they be able to read, because 68% of them are illiterate when they come in, and they can't read until they get there. But once they get in there, they then have a discussion with counselors, imams, and teachers about civic behavior relative to these other bodies of thought, including their own constitution now, etc. That's all that's being taught. The very precise course content, I'll grab, will we're going through here, I could touch on. But what I would say to those who think the United States of America is re-educating Iraqis in anything, I would say that they just simply are wrong. And then I would say that they haven't done their homework to understand what's really going on. The real courses are taught about honesty, truth, and time, women's rights, human rights in Islam, the rights of the non-Muslim, rights of parents, friendship, conversational manners, giving, generosity, and the list goes on. And the other component of it is the Iraqi history, society, structure, culture, traditions, citizenship, and the current rights under the government of citizenship, constitution, democracy, rule of law, reintegration, and there's another list there. So they come out of it, if they volunteer to go, with a very wholesome understanding about what's going on. And we think in part, not in whole, but we think in part, based on their feedback, not ours. By the way, did I tell you U.S. is not teaching it? I did say that, didn't I? It was all taught by Iraqis. Perhaps I should underline that point.
Paid for with American money, correct?
Well, clearly. Oh, clearly. All detention is. No ifs, ands, or buts. No questions about it.
Okay. I got one more quick question. I'm taking too much time. You mentioned you have sat in on, I wrote it down, 30,000 hours or something, for several thousand hours of interrogations with Al-Qaeda. I'd like to know if you could give us some insight why the insurgency, despite the occupation of Iraq by the United States and other coalition forces, continues despite your efforts. And what do they tell you, these Al-Qaeda folks? Thank you very much.
Why the insurgency? Well, let's again try to get the facts straight. What I said was the organization that I lead has done 30,000 interrogations. I monitor most of them. I didn't say they're all Al-Qaeda. In fact, in Al-Qaeda, in the compounds in detention, there are about 2,000 Al-Qaeda. So about 10% of the population-ish. A much higher percentage of the youth. And at last I left last week, the number was about 470 or so, and either dropping down. I think the feedback we got is the first number might be a 3 in the, in the weeks to come. But Al-Qaeda recruits the youth as they recruit others. And inside Al-Qaeda, there are various organizational levels. And I'll be glad to talk about all that. The insurgency, as you say, it is not a uniform insurgency. There's not one color of this. They don't all have one color T-shirt over there and we're fighting somebody. In fact, we're the only ones with uniforms on in Iraq. Besides the Iraqi police, they're our great counterparts, the Iraqi army and others. But in principle, there are those that are there from an ideological standpoint. Al-Qaeda is very real, very present, trying to adapt and determine the manner in which that they could exploit the resources, the people, gather from it, the funding, recruiting. And that is a much more global activity being practiced in Iraq, because Iraq's a very, very wealthy nation. Few nations in the world have oil and mineral and water and history of human education and open seaport and fertile ground like Iraq does. So it's a great place to try to plunder and take things from other folks, and Al-Qaeda's doing that, and they organize that way. But because it is such a rich nation, there are lots of other groups who align themselves in either religious and ethnic perspectives, who are fighting for elements of power. And that power is a different form of fight. I don't often view that as insurgency. I view that in a manner that doesn't exactly make sense to some of the people in the room, but when you move people out and you redraw the lines and who gets to vote in what area, which happens all the time in our country, we just call it gerrymandering. If it's done with force, it's gerrymandering, but it's done with force. And what is that? If you don't have a political or governance construct, that's a way to realign and try to build a power base, and that's what's going on. There are many there that are trying to build a power base, and it's not an unusual, odd historical perspective. If you've, and I'm sure you have, studied the history, you've been at this now for 60 months, after 40 years of a single rule, one over the top, one guy running the whole thing, with a construct that changed the nature of bureaucracy, changed the nature of how things got done, changed the nature of who got what rewards and when they got them. Exactly what would you expect in 60 months to have the whole society determine exactly how to take care of their bureaucracy and vote and, you know, get the trains and run and all the rest of it. I mean, it's a big task. And so if it's imperfect and it's not equal in each of the 15 different provinces, to me that doesn't sound particularly surprising. But they're not necessarily insurgents. I am very concerned, not only in terms of what goes on inside Iraq, but I am deeply concerned about the threat of Al-Qaeda. And of course, some of you know that I've had a tour in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and now here. And I view this as a very, very concerning issue for which they cannot, their business model cannot be allowed to be successful, if you allow me to mix metaphors. And we are going after it, and detention is one manner in which to do that. Because detention is not just holding individuals off the battlefield, keeping them away so that the security on the outside can have a chance to be raised up, to be replaced. It's why there's been 45,000 or more over the 2004 to now. We don't actually have good numbers in 2003, have been released and put back from the theater internment facility. So releasing is an important part of counterinsurgency warfare. It just is a necessary part. The question becomes, what do you do with the holdup? And maybe the part that I should have spent a little more time on after the riots is, what happens in a collective society of 1,000 men who are being properly taken care of, they're being guarded, they're being fed, they got their medical benefits, but we're not engaging in what they're doing and talking about on the inside of the theater internment facility? What if that's not happening? What if then in the closed circles of their tents, they have reorganized themselves as emirs and imams and put together the exact same cell structure inside that they had Al-Qaeda, but now are able to recruit them, bring them in, mandate that if they don't follow exactly the 80 or so misleading interpretations of the Quran that focus almost exclusively on the jihadist portions of the Quran and the Hadith, but the Quran, that are not, you know, going after the three basic radicalization process steps, and that's what these are. I'm oversimplifying here, but you know, the first is U.S. and the West are attacking Islam. Abdul, you have a problem. What are you going to do about it? Number two, your theology, and I already gave that to you, says quite clearly that that's not something that we can allow, and that's something that's justified. And then the last point is you've got to use violence to counter that. Now, the 120 or more imams that we have are moderate. They don't believe that. They know the jihadist verses, the lesser and the greater portions of the jihadist verses. They understand how they come together, and they can very comfortably place in context for the individual who wants to understand how they can be a perfectly functioning, celebrating Muslim and not have to follow the jihadist extremist perspective. But when they're in the compounds, if we don't engage in that discussion somehow, or get into that discussion, then they can bring them inside, break their legs, and say, with everybody else watching inside the quiet portion of the tent, this is what will happen to you now, to your families later, and to the future generations of your family, if you do not do it. And I want your name and network, because when I get out, and we will, when we get out, you're going to work for me. That's the network we've broken up. That's why there's no more violence. That's why there's no more engagement of that level of ideological intensity permitted by others. Those individuals are identified now increasingly by the moderate detainees themselves, extracted and brought out, placed in a different environment so that the rest of the population can do what it is that at least I define as victory. In a sense, the war is over. The moment war is, in the generic sense that, you know, we're speaking about it here, the moment that the moderate ummah marginalized the violent extremists. When that condition set is met, then it's done. But I don't think you speak Arabic, and I don't think everybody here is Muslim. And I don't think even if you were, you could fit and swim in the sea particularly very well. But only those who can, those moderates, are able to help do that. Now, they need leadership, and leadership is very important. I simplified it there. But that leadership right down the middle, oftentimes with a foot, a tough foot in one side and a moderate foot in the other, have got to help drag that across, because all religions have intensity to them. All religions have extremism to them. And on this topic, you can just ask how many abortion doctors have been killed because of So we can all ask these tough questions. So in the compounds, which are a reflection of the society, those individuals have to be dealt with. That's war fighting. War winning is when the moderates themselves say, I feel empowered to do this, I understand what the consequences are going to be, and I'm going to do it. And let me give you an example of who the moderate might be. 400 Iraqi men and women who are the imams, the counselors, the teachers, the psychiatrists, who day in and day out, with their face fully exposed, understand that they are dealing with and talking to men. We have 15, or had 15 women, so we'll say men and a couple women, are going to leave and go out and always know exactly who that individual is. Who's really taking the risk? Who's really placing their life on the line? Who is really trying to move the extremists and marginalize them? I would submit those Iraqis are doing it. And I would submit those Iraqis are staying in Iraq. I'm back here now. I just redeployed. I'm not going back. I mean, I'll go back aboard, but I'm not going back that I know of right now. But they are. They're not coming here. They don't have a passport to come to the United States. They don't have a passport, probably, to leave Iraq. And so for the rest of time, they have taken great risk to try to do exactly this mission inside their own country. And so from my perspective, those are valuable lessons learned. Because, comma, we didn't have it before we engaged on this. We didn't even have a construct upon which they could go into and engage in the theater internment facility to do that. And I could go on and on and on about that one.
Who's next?
Good question.
General Stone, it's an honor to know you and meet you, sir. My name is Faribors Frank Foladi. I'm Muslim, Persian native, proud Marylander, and an American patriot. I think the best way to deal with terrorism is to teach the people of Middle East and Africa to provide for themselves food, shelter, healthcare, and education. My company, Procurement USA Inc., we are locating locations 800 meter by 800 meter to model Montgomery County, Maryland, which I love a lot and I've been living there since 77. In order to do that, we require security in outside. Internal security we can provide. How do you recommend I approach the American military, in especially in Afghanistan and Iraq, to ask for protection outside the 800 meter by 800 meter vicinity? First. Secondly, I want to say, as General MacArthur said, now that I listen to you, you guys never die, you just fade.
Probably true. Well, I think the simple answer is, if there is a workable solution to engage in the population that brings about a form of security and provides for the essential services of that population, which is what you just said, but using oversimplified counterinsurgency manual commentary from 3-24. The U.S. Forces in any one of those provinces would engage with either giving you direct security or, and probably increasingly, or engage with the Iraqi army or Iraqi police to do that. There are... Well, I think the simple answer would be that you have to, you mean like, who do you dial and call in? Yeah, okay. Well, talk to me afterwards and we'll get you connected. But you make a very important point, and on this point, I would turn to His Excellency the Ambassador here and raise the question, since we know the Iraqi, I'm sorry, since we know the theater internment facilities in Iraq are becoming perhaps a more perfect society, and you say to me, how could that conceivably be? Do you know that we have tons of guys researching about the 20-some thousand down at Buka? And they've asked just these very simple questions. What if a society has 20,000 males in the world who have better nutrition, medical care, commonly ruled out all the U.S. cities, educational benefits, freedom of worship, complete and total security, a well-understood rule of law, constant continuous family visitation, 21 different job types for which they can make an earning and give it to their families. Let's try in the globe to find a society that has 20,000 males that does that. Key to the insurgency, and I won't go through the more global perspectives of the demographics because they're very, very important in terms of how an ideological movement can spread, is the addressing of the precise essential services that allow for the individuals to be able to at least make the cognitive decision. And so I look to our friends and I say, you know, there's a lot of money sitting in the New York bank. Let's take that money and give it to the Iraqis to be educated. By my personal estimate, there's 4.5 million Iraqi men that are probably at risk. Maybe I'm wrong. There's certainly 450,000 that are deeply at risk. It takes $300 a month to cover the incremental difference. In fact, $300 a month is exactly the nominal motivator for most of those that are not ideologically oriented, who have joined and been recruited by those that are, to join in the insurgency. Why? Because under Saddam Hussein, there were things they couldn't have. A cell phone, a satellite dish, a refrigerator, a car, whatever. But they didn't cost that much. So now, in what are family units, and some of the most interesting analysis that we've done in the last few months, is that there's only about 30% of all the detainees who go in who are in there because they individually made the decision to do it. The majority went in because their family decided to do it. And I'm not going to oversimplify this, but if you're the only guy in your family and you live with your family, and 79% all live with their family or extended family, you're the only one with a cell phone, it doesn't exactly work. Kind of like going to talk to your uncle. So he needs a cell phone. Well, if he needs a cell phone, he needs it. So if there's a lot of money flowing out there, and Al-Qaeda's got a lot of money, it's flowing in from a couple different countries, and it's not a mystery where, they got the money, they're paying these guys, they're fighting a coalition, not U.S., but Iraqis as well. Why don't we solve that problem? Because that happens to be one of the key issues in terms of the major insurgent group. So let's use the money to kind of solve that problem. It's about $1.7 billion-ish, maybe less, per month to get 4 million guys, at-risk guys, off the streets. And we'll go through all the other costs and the trade-offs, but you can do the arithmetic. Because in a sense, that's what I've done inside the theater internment facility. And then you begin to engage with the more ideological and radical perspective that is genuinely very effective. One individual can affect hundreds in a manner that it is unbelievable. And I do this, and pardon me, women, because I'm a huge women's rights supporter, huge. So please don't, but I just came out of an all-male environment, as you know. And so, I mean, detention's an all-male environment, basically. So I would ask you, how many of you believe, you got a Korean War vet and there's others, how many of you believe that I could take 1,000 American men as you know them, nominal age 26, put them 1,000 behind, you know, the fence that sometimes falls over in the storm with a little barbed wire at the top, etc., for 3 years with a guard ratio of one guard for 22 or 25. How many think for 3 years those 1,000 men would stay inside the fence? Raise a hand. How many? I mean, I'm sincere. So you don't think it would happen, right? You don't. But it has in Iraq. Why? The answer to that has to do with cultural issues, and we could go on about that. So if it's a prison and you want to break out, that's one thing. If it's a prison that's detention and something else is happening, that's a different thing. Where is the prison in the construct of a detention facility? Is it physical or is it mental? And if it's mental, who's trying to put who into what prison? Now, I don't want to get too metaphorical here, but I think you can put two and two together. If it's a battlefield of the mind, and that is my major perspective on this, and it is an ideological issue that we have to contend with, you most assuredly have to take care of the body first. You have to address the cultural issues, but you have to engage those who also want to believe that that prison and that is a prison, is different than the detention facility in which they're at. And if you don't solve that problem, the ability to be able to recruit, to be able to excite, and to move people forward to come to anywhere they want to go is profound. Don't address that issue, as when people understand this, they say about four words, and generally I understand where they're going. You would, I presume, agree in concept with what I'm talking about.
Please,
let me finish one other point. Do you know what is common amongst the everyone, and we had 300 or so at the time I got there, foreign fighters, third country nationals, who were genuinely foreign fighters? Do you know, was it their language? No, there's 21 different countries. Was it the country they came from? Obviously not. Was it the way they... What was the one single common denominator amongst every one of them? No, well, that may be the case. Actually, I didn't relate to that. The answer is they've all seen a 7-minute recruiting film done by Al-Qaeda on the internet by Abu Ghraib. It's the only common denominator. So if that's the only common denominator, would a program that does something different work inside the world? Could it communicate a different kind of U.S. culture to the broader Ummah in the Islamic world? Is that possible? And if it was effective to get Abu Ghraib to get so many to come over and kill so many thousands, because these guys are effective, when they come over, the reason we don't have lots and lots of really terrible, terrible guys is because they fight to die. They fight to die. They will not quit. We get them sometimes, but trust me when I tell you, they fight to die. So is it a big surprise I don't have a lot of them sitting around in the detention center? No. So my point is, and I'm trying to be clear about this, the way we deal with detainees, probably more than anything else that I can think of in theater, determines the outcome, at least on this battlefield, of where it's going to go. And if we are successful in this battlefield, and then you just have to have a leap of faith that we're going to have to do it elsewhere in some form. And I'm not saying detention. I'm saying fight this war in some form. These are lessons, and valuable lessons, upon which we can ride to try to determine how to put it back. The first being, the moderates have to engage with us. They have to believe that we are being sincere. And I go back to my first commentary about the act, not the words. The words, frankly, the words don't mean anything unless you have an action in the U.S. We just believe it. Culturally. When somebody said, I believe it. Now, you guys, some of you are reporters, so you would never believe it. But all that aside, you're the guys that drag out and go through attention. And then you think I staged it. So then I don't go with you anymore. And then you think I still didn't stage it, but it doesn't matter. I love the reporters. That's why we brought in hundreds and hundreds. That's why we're here. I'm not afraid to talk about these issues.
Go ahead. Let me go to... Microphone, please.
Since you are a scholar in Quran, in the Surah Spider and Kabut, in the first 10 ayah, I don't know which one, it says, if you make jihad, right. You make jihad for yourself, God doesn't need you.
Yeah. But when I was in Pakistan, I used to go to the madrasas, and I will tell you it's a big problem, and I'm not trying to belittle it, but one of the most interesting things for me, being new into it, was to sit and to watch a teacher say in Urdu to the student, Abdul, this is your jihad. And I'm going, shit, the jihad, it's right here, it's happening. And he would be talking, and I'd be looking at his paper, and he'd be trying to add these numbers together. And I go, how could these add them? Like this one IED and one IED mixed in two IEDs. What is this? It's just his jihad. It's just his God's challenge to him that day in this way to learn. So we have to be very cautious about this. I mean, I can't tell you how many intel guys and interrogations I've heard them use the word, and people used to come unglued. I mean, our guys are now more seasoned than that. But I mean, you just have to put it in context, and you have to understand it. But so you're exactly right. Sir.
My name is Masoom Stanikzai. I'm a senior fellow at the Institute of Peace from Afghanistan. My question is, as you rightly mentioned, that this is the age of information technology, and this is the age of propaganda.
Mm.
But my question is that whoever you put at detention center or in a prison, the days they are released, whatever approach you have, whatever way you are treating them, they will, when they go out, they will face with two conditions. Mm-hmm. The first condition would be that the Al-Qaeda and the insurgency will treat them as somebody who was put at the detention center, and they will be the first target for recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
The second point would be, if they are starting to defend the system or the process that is already ongoing as a moderate, they will be seen as somebody that has been changed, and your life will be in the threat. The third point is how you are, because the experience in Afghanistan has proven that some of the people who were released from the detention centers or whatever prisons, they become so aggressive fighters in many ways in different parts, and they fight very extensively. And some of the people who really didn't want you to fight, they went without any follow-up. Mm-hmm. So what you are doing when you release these 3,000, 2,000, 5,000 after they left the detention center, what is the follow-up stage for them to be engaged?
You're spot on, but I want to make sure we, again, parse out something here. The rule of law, the authorities to detain, and the reason for detaining, et cetera, are profoundly different in Afghanistan than they are in Iraq. Profoundly different, as they are in Gitmo. They are not the same system. And again, I want to caution you, just because the word starts with the D and it sounds like detention doesn't mean it's the same. Okay, so let's be quite clear about that. That being said, the concept of what happens to somebody who has been through this, and let me just use, I don't like bumper stickers, but sometimes in these things you got to get to them. If this society is right, looks like this, I mean, this is the way we want it to be, and detainees themselves will tell you this is what they want. They want this kind of society. That is why so many right now do not want to leave detention. That is why so many on the youth side are trying to get their siblings into detention, because the society feels right. It's for all those reasons I aforementioned. But you are spot on. What happens when they cross that boundary and they go back? Their outside society does not reflect the inside society. Now, I would defer all questions to the Iraqi government, because I don't know what that line and condition is. But I agree with you, and we are working in two ways that I know of, and then probably two other ways that I'm not as directly involved with. The first one is we are trying to put for 6 months a monitoring program where the individual will come back for a stipend to kind of keep them off, out of the fight. Our current thinking is, in the 276, I guess, that we've experimented with have been piloted program that have been, you know, somewhat encouraging, is to take the civics book and work it out into the population. I mean, the Iraqi population and the Iraqi people are remarkably moderate, wonderful people. I could talk to you about, I mean, your understanding of it from the press about the, you know, the aggressiveness is at the leadership level, and, you know, it gets boiled down to just a few things, and the, you know, the Shia hate the Sunni and all the rest of that. Inside the detention, Shia and Sunni do everything together. Everything. Unless their primary reason for coming in was because they were supposed to be killing the other one, in which case they are separated. And we have that, a couple thousand or so to separate. But then we have all the work programs, all the education programs, even the religious, I mean, not the religious studies, but even the, you know, the civics and discussions around this, it's all the same. They're very comfortable. 97% of the detainees inside there have zero concern if their family member marries the other sex. They don't care. They don't even care if the women wear the hijab. And I could go through all the you know, statistics on this. So my hope is that the program will carry somewhat. But I'm not naive. I'm dealing inside my domain. This is it. I mean, I've got my arms around this issue. I can't take it to the greater societal issue. I've not been asked to do that. The second question is, inside each one of the PRTs are vocational programs, educational programs. We are moving this material out. The division CGs are doing their own reintegration processes. So there are a lot of efforts to try to get that out into society. But I'm not going to disagree with you 1 second on the basic thesis that you postured, that if they go out, they'll be taken back, etc. Now, we know that. We also know it's gone the other way. We also know that some Al-Qaeda guys, if the right set and group and family and tribe get themselves released together, they best be leaving town or they're going to be underground. So, you know, it doesn't exactly just go one way. But it does go that way. And You know, it's not a simple answer. But what I will tell you, and I get this kind of question a lot, and statement a lot, is would it be better just to not do anything about it? Because I can tell you what that looks like. I can tell you that thousands and thousands of well-rehearsed, well-built guys who are now, if they weren't, you know, a believer in jihad before, I mean, jihad is a good thing, depending upon where you interpret it. But if you, the radical ideological perspective that they've been used to be built inside, if they don't, if they still have that, they are going to be first war fighters when they go out. And I have met releasees from Gitmo in Saudi. Hundreds of them that are over there. I've met them, eyeball to eyeball. And I've met thousands and thousands and thousands of our detainees when they're released. There is a difference. And the difference goes back to my opening comments about care and custody, what the focus is, what your orientation is, who we as a people are with this other culture and what we're trying to do together. What is the common security boundary condition, not the separate security boundary condition? And is a process that we create creating a problem for that other process at a greater rate? I mean, some of my very best Iraqi friends said in the first days that I got there, you might be better to let everybody out than to keep doing what you're doing. Oh, how right that statement was, in my judgment.
Peace. Sure. Good afternoon, General. My name is Murad Iqbal, University of Baltimore, Center for International Comparative Law. As a small civilian component or contribution to your efforts, my university and law school signed an agreement with the University of Tikrit in November of 27, 2007 for support of rule of law and exchange of faculty and students. I have two particular questions and an observation. The observation I have is that by all public accounts, there was no evidence of Al-Qaeda's presence in Iraq before we started shock and awe, or on shock, whichever way it was. And the question I have, which tags on to the question my predecessor asked, but in a different way, you spoke about prospective threat to peace and security as a criterion or one element to the detainees being brought in and kept.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas coming into the detainment camp, that may be clear and apparent because you have some action that gives rise to that. We don't just go around arresting everybody and presume that they are a threat unless they're probable cause. What consideration has been given that in fact you've now extended the timeline of a potential threat and cause, no matter how well we're treating these individuals, because no human being likes to be kept, whether we call it incarceration or we call it detainment, the net result is that it is an appreciable reduction in the freedom of movement and the freedom of communication. So we've now extended the timeline where the person may be released, and 5 or 10 years later, all of a sudden something happens, the light goes off, and we have now egregious and violent behavior on that part, which at that time may be extraordinary, but can be traced back to the experiences they had in the detention camps, no matter how good that experience is. Question number one. Question number two, from what I know, and it may be precious little compared to your own experiences, some of the techniques of Al-Qaeda find their roots in Al-Qaeda's experience in Afghanistan during the time of Soviet occupation. And I find it quite extraordinary that some of the techniques that were then applied by the Afghani counterinsurgents against the Soviet military that pushed the military ultimately out apparently are being applied mutatis mutandis in Iraq as well, and appear to have their net disastrous impact. And I'd like to have your thoughts on both of those questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, you're coming at this from a legal argument, and there's nothing wrong with that. Rule of law is absolutely essential. I want to then make sure you understand there is no requirement under the UN Security Charter for me to... I will dig out the exact statement here in 1 second. But we're not required to have evidence. We're not required to... these are not arrests. They're not arrests. I could walk the dog for you and all that. They don't have to go to court. They don't have to have anybody represent them. You know, I mean, all these things are perfectly appropriate inside, you know, the lex generalis versus lex specialis. I mean, you know, we could have one supplants the other, and I could tell you about all I knew in about four sentences there, but at the end of the day, it's a perfectly legal, entirely appropriate rule of law, whose end objective is to have human rights law, which does, of course, have the evidence, the courts, etc. And that's where we're going. And in many cases where we have been very successful with having the law of war, otherwise known as the international human rights law, where we've had that in place, it has been able to create the conditions where the human rights law has been able to come up, where the judges are not being killed. And of course, you know, I've seen 26 judges killed since I've been over there. And so, you know, and they work very closely with us in terms of giving pledges and that sort of thing. They're dear friends. I should have listed them. In fact, a huge mistake by not listing them in a former group when I did talk about the Iraqis, because they are truly putting their lives at risk, and there's no question about that. So the answer to your first question is that it is possible that any form of detention, regardless of what it is, could make the problem worse. Most, if not all, prison systems, Egypt, etc., Qatab and others, I mean, they all created the radical ideologies. It is my personal thesis, completely unfounded, and one that, you know, we will watch and see how it shakes out, that if a detention facility, in that case a prison, but let's use the confinement component, men confined, can be used to develop radical perspectives, and the three that were developed are now substantively the construct upon which bin Laden has argued, you know, his theology, then couldn't it be the other way? Is it possible? And to this end, we've had at least eight that I know of with the authority of the endowment of Iraq gone out, are now practicing moderate Islamic belief in their mosques, with the more radical former imams moved out, who are using the Abu Shuja, the 800,000-year-old text by, I think, Imam Shujafi, who showed the exercises on how the Quran ought to be lived. That practice is now working. If that is true, then I would argue very coherently this could be a good experiment and a good methodology to be replicated elsewhere, because it will have the exact same effect but for the positive. But I would readily admit, in the absence of that, if you were to continue to conduct yourself along the lines of what was seen at Abu Ghraib, you will create extremism in perpetuity. Point one. Point two, then, is about the practices of Al-Qaeda against the Soviets. And we would have to parse out what you mean, but I would agree with you, the tactics by the Mujahideen used, in the way that the Soviets mecked up, and all of those kinds of tactics have a parallel concern. And I know that our forces have looked at that. General Austin, who is the core commander. I mean, let's just make it perfectly clear. And what did General Petraeus? And I'm part of the surge team, right? I mean, I got there in April, you know, March, or whatever it was. So what did General Petraeus do differently? And he said was, get out and get into town. And go as far as can up front, take it off, and eat with them. That's a pretty profound difference, and then they did it. That is not what happened in the Afghan war. Would you agree? So what happened was they went to the FOB, and I don't want to drag everybody through the history on the war, but the tactics, if, again, and my answer to you would be, if we were to fall back into that construct, we would become precisely the same tactic. You are precisely right. The training camps that were being used early on were doing that. But they are not effective when Lance Corporal Stone is out front doing it, or, and I'm going to be clear, not effective when we're engaging with detainees one-on-one in the environment we are. So you are precisely right. Both fears or concerns are right. Failure to adapt and have a different response will result in a replication of the exact same mistakes made before. That's why what I think we're doing, while imperfect, is at least better. Thank you for your question.
Next, please.
Good afternoon, General Stone. My name is Nick Harris. I'm with the Center for Global Peace at American University. I think we just kind of touched upon a concept that I've been rolling around in my mind. It seems that at the same time that the new detention methods were being tried, the United States was mobilizing it. The awakening councils in Anbar province and other areas like Diyala to try to get local tribal law and tribal sheikhs to operate in security. In what ways are there linkages between the Cascade moral rehabilitation that you have and the awakening movements? And my second question is, it seems like some of the worst sectarian killers come in from organizations such as the Baada Brigades or the Al-Mahdi Army that are linked with powerful movements, Shia in this case, it doesn't have to be Shia, in Iraq. And if we go by the concept that all politics is local, how would you conceive of methods to promote intersectarian cooperation using the rehabilitation models that you have?
Let me take the second one first, because I don't know how you know about our reconciliation councils, but thanks for mentioning, because they are profoundly amazing to me. I mean, the pictures, which we're not allowed to show because they show the faces, and the actual experience of being in there, are disquieting to somebody who believes that these are all bloodthirsty killers and that, you know, these terrible things are going to happen to them. Because they would walk into a room about this size, and what my Afghani friends would know as a yurga, and they would sit in the council. There would be one U.S. uniformed guard in there. One. And they're not, you know, not weaponed up. They have long discussions on just this topic. They come up with constructs upon which, inside their compound and with another compound, they are going to live. They are, initially, they were facilitated by the Iraqis that are part of it. Now, thousands and thousands conduct these, and we are led to believe they take that same process of Shia and Sunni sitting together, how they construct the discussion, what they focus on, how they problem solve, and taking it outside. Now, I'm not there, and this is hard work, and I don't have time to do the research to jump outside there. I would love to, you know, but history will see it, and somebody will note it, and someday somebody will say, you know, I don't know where the hell did you get that? Got it at Buka. You know, that's what I think will happen. I mean, in my going out presentation, I said, and I believe it, someday the ambassador to, the senator of, the council member from, or whatever, is going to be an American detainee. The question will be, how do they see their world because of how we treated them? So the question becomes, maybe we have a future president of Iraq, future ambassador. We certainly have a lot of the leadership of Iraq who have been detained, not necessarily from coalition. So we'll see. So I think you're spot on. My hope is that the detainees themselves take it out, is maybe a better way to say it. Those who are familiar with Tipping Point would say, I hate to use other people's words because somebody's going to take it out of context, but the concept of the social epidemic, okay, my Marine major doctor said, don't ever say the word because they're going to think it's VD or something. But, you know, this is a behavioral concept done by Tipping Point, and it's a well-documented theory. That construct could work. I would hope it would work. And we are laying the footstones for it to work. We'll do anything we can to empower that. Again, the basic concept, empower the moderates. Well, first of all, how do you get moderates into detainees functions? You take the extremists out. Okay, now you got moderates. The moderates are the ones that are not, it's not in their ideology to kill innocents. And I can go on. And then they start this process to continue to keep pushing the movement. This is one of them. So thank you for recognizing it, because it's very functional and it works unbelievably. I mean, to the extent that I had no violence inside the theater internment facility, when they could not walk by a compound. I mean, I had 12 American service members in the first few months pulled out of theater of the 78 that left their blood. Excuse me. It's a Korean thing. On the ground from these guys getting hit from exactly that kind of rock being thrown at them, because that's what they can do. Not one. Now, they didn't walk by with a battle rattle on anymore, because it just doesn't happen. So that's a construct that could go into this society. Back to your first point about the awakening movement. I don't know where that awakening movement actually started. I don't want to speak to it. I don't know who planted the seed or exactly what happens. There's folklore about it, but at the end of the day, what we can say is that the tribes got fed up with other behavior, Al-Qaeda extremist behavior, and they did exactly what you would expect in this environment. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. They merged and they took them on. We then empowered that, which is exactly what you want. Empowering the moderate, in this case maybe not much, but empowering them to do their work. It's their country. Move on. Great. Got it. Want to help. So they get a road vest, a hat, and an AK and money or whatever, right? For sons of Iraq. I am not comfortable with putting detainees into that construct, personally. Because the aforementioned, one of the men earlier said, you know, they're going to go back and they're going to be looked at a certain way. They are. They just are. So it's not a good construct for it, in my opinion. Furthermore, I would rather see a public works program across all of Iraq, along the lines of what I mentioned to the ambassador. I mean, use the money, the oversight, the billions of dollars, and get every at-risk male at work cleaning canals, building the power lines, putting the roads down. I mean, there's tons and tons and tons of work, the construct of which, the infrastructure of which, would bring in security, I mean, and bring in risk dollars that would then grow the country. I mean, I had this debate and have since I got there. You know, I mean, I'm perplexed, right? I mean, I come out of a business environment, and I come out of a warfighting, you know, in a military environment. So I can say very comfortably, jobs make security as much as security makes jobs. And the art and the nuance here is, when's one doing more than the other? When does it stop the insurgent forces being able to be recruited? And I think everybody needs to play a role in that, and that takes investment. And the investment like that is public dollars. I mean, there's not a perfect model for it, but we did it during the Depression. So that's how I would answer the first question. And then I will just tell you, I'm hoping that these guys get out and get two jobs. We're very, very, very focused on trying to make that happen. The hopeful piece of it, and then we'll go to the next question. The hopeful piece of it is, initially in my first 2 months of the research to try to figure out who we had, because there has been no research in terms of who was in detention. So I don't know. All I saw was 15, 16, 20,000 down praying from the ground. You know, fly over in a helicopter every day, and I see them all praying. And they're all walking around in huge circles, you know, memorizing. So I thought, this is not good. But then you start to figure out why they're there, and you parse it out, and then you start to tease it out, and then you break it up, and then we got what we got now. But when I first saw that, I would have said, holy mackerel, you know, we can never do it. Now I'm pretty comfortable these guys go out, join the awakening movement, and move on. I mean, we had an incident a couple weeks ago, which there are small things, and when you're a practitioner of it, you see them. We had an early incident long time ago about detainees inside the compound. We couldn't figure out who's who in the zoo, right? We just know we got problems. And they had fed up with these guys, just like on the outside, and they locked them in the water closet. I think it was in a blog, and somebody put it in the news. It's often I get questions about it. But it was a monumental event for us. Huge. I mean, we just... What do you mean they self-policed? How did that happen? I mean, were they doing it for us? How did that happen? Well, it was the very beginning, just the beginning of what is now everyday events. Up to and including the detainees themselves and others are involved with the assessment when they come through. So we don't get it set up wrong in the first place.
Next question.
Hi. I'm Brent Gennaro from Human Rights Watch. I'm also a USC alum, so I'm glad to hear you speak today. My question is simply, if you have an idea of numbers of detainees who will be transferred to the Iraqi court system?
We're in the future or have in the past?
Both.
Okay, we are providing Human Rights Watch the latter. Detainee 134 is providing all those numbers now. But I can give you the general answer is about 2,000-ish. There have been, I think, more than 1,700 cases that actually got. There were 2,000 that might have gone, 1,700, and then I think 1,100 or 1,200 that were actually found, to be processable. How many will go forward to the court system? So what you're really saying is, when the international rule of law changes to the human rights form of law, that's what you're really saying. When lex specialis is converted to lex generalis, when that construct is changed and this permission slip isn't allowed anymore, how many will go to a court system? The answer will remain with the Iraqi courts. My guess is very few. And I tell you that because the Iraqis have access to and or ask for, or we volunteer, as much of the evidence as we have now for them to take them into a court system so that they could then be adjudicated and put into a prison. It may or may not change the definition of imperative security risk. Just because somebody's found guilty of being a pickpocket doesn't mean that they're not still counter-coalition activity. I mean, there's, just because they rape somebody may not mean that they're not still a counter-coalition IED, you know, manufacturer or financier. So, you know, guilt under one system is not necessarily ex post facto guilt on the other or the other way around. These are two very different systems. It was started, I think, somewhat naively to view, as you would just say, everybody that comes in, they're not an EPW. They're all guilty of a crime. So therefore, every one of the Marines, sailors, soldiers are policemen, and they are arresting. They have posse comitatus. They got the right to do that. That, of course, is none of that's true. They're not trained in that. I mean, I trained the 35 battalions, Marine battalions, whatever. That's not what they're trained to do. It's not, I mean, they're trained to do the right thing. But they're not trained to be policemen. That's not what they do. And there are no Iraqi policemen out there because they were being killed. And there are no courts because the judges are dead. And so there is no courts, cops, and corrections in outside of, to be brutally honest, the green zone, where we're trying desperately to get in there and live in there with their families so they won't get killed. So that's where we're at. Now, I love the organization. I mean, aspects of it are, you know, peculiar to my way of thinking. But all that being said, the issue on the ground is, when does this rule of law go, you know, change over? And I spent an awful lot of time, hours and hours and hours, with your cohorts in Baghdad just the other day going through this and giving them, I wrote it up and I gave them my writing on it and I handed it out, and I'll be glad to hand it to you as well at the end of this. But I think it is exactly the right thing to be doing. The debate in Iraq today should be less about these kinds of issues, and it ought to be more about, when is the process for the human rights rule of law to sort of take over? And in order to do that, you'd have to turn to the ambassador and others, and they'd say, I have enough policemen, courts, corrections facilities, rule of law, security to do that. That when the police see something go wrong, they can go out, lay the yellow tape, don't anybody touch me now, don't shoot, I'm going to go in and investigate, I'm going to, you know, CSI-like thing, you know, and then get all this evidence. There will be no problem at all. I just cut the yellow tape, and then I get in, I'm going to drive out. Today, to do that, you have to go in the dark. You're going to be IED'd when you go in. You'll clearly be shot at from multiple directions, if and only if you can get inside and you get the individuals out. It's not exactly the moment in time you say, let's sit down and talk at the moment about, you know, where you were at the time. You just get people, and then you bring them out, and you pray to God you can keep them safe and yourself safe as you go by the IEDs and all the rest of them to fight your way back to sit down and go, okay, now, you're supposed to be a part of this thing. Did you, you know, whatever, and build that up. I have invited and want to invite you and others to go out and practice human rights in those situations, human rights law in that situation. You know, do it. I mean, everybody and their uncle wants it to happen. The problem is, you wouldn't live a day. And if you did, the Iraqis would do it because the Iraqis know how to live a day in their own country. And they can't get it working right now because there's too many people trying to kill them. And that's what we're there to help them. And it is working. In many, many, many places where we're able to work with and get them, the Iraqi police are trained, they're taking charge of it, they're backing up. The courts are now moving out. At a Blue Diamond, we're building a courthouse. That's right in the old heat of our land bar. So it's starting to work. But it isn't a question of how many are going into the Iraqi court system. It's a gift of God we can even have a court system down there and that it's up and functioning. And I'm going to tell you one other thing. Say what you will about the decisions, and I've watched hundreds of court cases adjudicated of coalition forces. And, you know, we don't adjudicate courses. I don't have lawyers do it. We don't try them. We're not involved with that. We just simply go out and get the evidence, and then we sit in the bleachers and watch it like everybody else does. And you can sit in the bleachers and watch a coalition case, or you can sit and watch the bleachers watch another case. I mean, it's all right there, and it's happening every day. But in the course of watching those, what I have watched are judges who have had the highest percentage, as best I can tell, I don't know, I defer to the ambassador, but it's a big number, of their profession killed, coming to work every day, they don't live in a highly secure environment. They get in there, and regardless of Shia or Sunni, they adjudicate as they see the evidence, regardless of the outcome. oftentimes under threat conditions that are phenomenal, but they do it. And I mean, it is to me remarkable.
Nabil.
My name is Nabil Al-Tukridi, U.S. Institute of Peace. I have two or three questions. One is, you've discussed sort of the basis of this conflict as one of being, where the enemy is basically an Islamist one. Does that mean, by extension, that all of your detainees have been Muslim, effectively? Are there any Yazidis, Shabaks, Sabaeans, Assyrians, Chaldeans amongst the population? A related question, side question to that, is do you keep sectarian statistics and do you segregate your detainees according to sectarian bases? Third question is, if the U.S. does decide to withdraw, would you advocate for the immediate evacuation of those 400 Iraqis that work with this venture? And finally, you referred once to a civics book. Is that book public? Or is, I mean, is there actually one book? Is it public and can we see it?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Thank
okay.
you.
And always tells me if I go backwards. So I'll, first of all, the work that is in the civics text that they use is more than public. It's handed out to all the detainees when they leave. So most assuredly, it's out there. Yeah, I mean, I can't get it to you, but you know, these guys can
somebody
go back. The captain's on civilian activity. So. You know, now I could walk you through what the curriculum is and that sort of thing, but it's, I mean, there's books and they're published, and I mean, they're not books, it's not like you can go down and get a book, but we actually have the courses and all that stuff is there. So, and they're handed out by the hundreds, in fact, I think, I don't know today, but we were giving them to every detainee when they left, so, sure. And let me make one other point, too. The civics construct and discussion changes all the time as we learn more. And I could give you personal experience on this day in and day out, mistakes that I make in the parlance that aided and abetted the situation unknowingly. So there is no book for this. It doesn't exist. We had to create it, and the imams and counselors and others have done it. In terms of withdrawal to protect those people, I would do anything to protect them. So I would certainly support anything that protected them. I think, to be honest with you, they wouldn't want to leave. They would want to stay, and they would want to be protected. I mean, we have had these kinds of discussion. You know, they oftentimes ask for assistance for family members, and I do everything I can to provide it for them. But if they didn't want to be there, they wouldn't be there. And these are gutsy, courageous individuals who want their country to turn around. And they are, I mean, they're not imports. They're not guys from, you know, Detroit who decided to go back. I mean, there are some of those. These are Iraqis. And, you know, I mean, I don't think they're going to want to leave. That's my insensitive, and that's what I hear, and I talk to them every day. So, I mean, but if they wanted to go, you know, turn to the ambassador and say, if you get those 12,000 or whatever the number is, and these guys want to go, you bet your ass. I mean, I protect them any way I can. I do now. I do anything I can to keep them safe. You know, inshallah, we've not had any hurt. In terms of sectarian separation inside the compound, I already answered, yes, we do that. A couple, two or three of the compounds are, you know, Shia and Sunni are mixed together, not infrequently brothers and or uncles or cousins, you know, who may be from a different mother, that sort of thing, who practice a different sect, will ask to and go into the compounds if they want to. There's no issue with that. Where we do draw the line is if they came in because their primary purpose was to kill the other sect, and we know that through interrogation and what they're doing, then we don't do that, because that'll only result in the obvious. So we don't do that. But in thesis, it's important to underline the point. No job program, VOTEC program, education course, civics class, sports program, recreation is done strictly Sunni or Shia now. And I can tell you, it might be one of these kinds of guys. They say, well, like every class? No, because there are 4,000 Shia, and there are 16,000 Sunni. So you can't everybody have one, okay? And of these, there some aren't in that group. So it's not that easy to do that. But I just want to make clear. And then in terms of this Islamist, they're not all Islamists. I do frame the issue because that's the one that I'm most concerned about. I want the Iraqi government to be successful and sovereign. I want General Petraeus' mission, the multinational force, to be successful with all my heart. I am also worried about the other more global threat. And I would disagree, as would those who are quite knowledgeable about it, what Al-Qaeda's intent was before as it relates to Al-Qaeda. Iraq before, and their understanding of who Saddam Hussein was and what just read Bin Laden's writings about Hussein and what he said. Just read them and then come back to me and tell me they didn't have eyes on it. My experience in Bin Laden's writings, and I've read them all, is pretty much walks his talk. So from him, I would say, you know, for those that didn't see that, you know, go do your own homework. But there are probably about 50 others. There's a couple Christians. You know, there are others that have been wrapped up in the counter-coalition activity. And on this, I want everybody to be a little cautious. The research that we have done tells us that on balance, with all due respect to my Iraqi friends, they're not overly religious men. Right. The detainees themselves are not. Okay. 68% are illiterate. The vast majority are either construction workers, farmers, or unemployed students. And 96% would support their daughter or their sister marrying the other sect. 87% would say that the other sect is a perfectly good Muslim. There's no issue with them being a good Muslim. And 13%, because they are not studied in their own religion, would say there isn't any difference between the two, Shia and Sunni, which is a striking revelation for some of us. And I can go on about the list. I mean, let me give you another one that I think is fascinating, because I'm going to get the right number here. Remember I told you where they are, where they live, and I don't know how many have flown over Iraq. You know, I flew over virtually every day. It is fascinating to me that you could fly at a pretty fast rate out and across the middle of the desert, and then suddenly you look down, you'll see a guy with a bunch of sheep and walking, and then you think, I just flew here, there's like nothing on either side of me, and the guy's still walking. Where's he going? That's where many live. Okay, in an outside environment like that. So when I tell you this, somebody's going to say hogwash. 36% have actually not been in mosques. Not mosques as you know them. They may draw lines on the ground, as the detainees will do. That constitutes under the law that can be a mosque. But in a mosque, 36 haven't been in. Only 28% go every week. 30% go sometimes. So essentially, this is a little like my brothers. You know, they go to church on the holy days. Maybe. Okay? They're not really church-going guys. And so, the question asked earlier about, geez, they're in this mandatory education program. The reality is they're going in there because they want to hear about it. That's the first time they've ever had anybody sit down with them that now they can read, which is the number one thing that they'll all talk about. I don't care how many times you go up and talk to their family, they'll say, this is a good thing, I finally learned how to read. The first thing they'll tell you is, I can now read about religion, and this discussion is telling me about something I didn't know. This is my religion. And they are very proud of their religion. Even the Takfirists are monumentally proud, and I believe, on balance, holy men. They want to believe the Quran. They just have the wrong belief structure, you know, relative to what the more moderates believe. They are too over the edge, and they are ignoring other passages. So, a long-winded explanation, but they're not all Islamists, a very small percentage, probably not more than about 50, if that, very, very small number. Sectarian under the way we said, withdrawal, of course, and civics book, yours.
General, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we have to get you to an airport.
Okay, I can take someone, I can answer them fast.
Very quickly, sir. Yeah. My name is Robert Bergner. I'm a retired chief warrant officer in Marine Speak. I'm a gunner. I served as a chief interrogator at Abu Ghraib in January 2004.
Really?
What I'm hearing from you is a hell of a lot better than what I had to hear from Geoffrey Miller.
You got that right.
Question. In your planning, what are you doing to prevent the scenario that put artillerymen in close proximity to prisoners? The Army, the Marines, we have very strict standards about who deals with prisoners. Miller threw those out and just put a bunch of our cannon cockers.
All the vast majority of detainee guards are in LUAs. This means they are, and this will scare you, Gunner, they are centermen, bakers, they are clerks, but they go school, they do program, they go through before we get them at Fort Dix and Nelson, and the program is one that we go out and we monitor. They get a ton of, you know, instruction when they're on the ground. They have been marvelous. And I'm going to give you, when you leave, a copy of a letter that I gave to the troops when I departed. And you can sort of have a sense of what at least I think about them. So it isn't good. It isn't great. It's not perfect. They're not all MPs. Every compound does have an MP. Battalion commander is an MP. They are very well trained. But the issues that I have seen for discipline have been non-existent. Easier when the detainees make it easier. But
that's a much different perspective than I believe.
Yes, sir.
And I'm glad to hear it's changed.
Yes, sir. Oh, no, this is not your...
Let me interrupt the natural order of things and offer the ambassador an opportunity to say a word.
Sir.
Thank you very much.
You're going to need the microphone.
Thank you. I see the line out there growing even longer. I don't want to keep the general. I'm very grateful for all the work which he's done. I was there in the Governing Council when this program of detainees started, mm-hmm. and I think it's public knowledge that it was chaotic and resulted in the catastrophic Abu Ghraib practice. Now, this is a much more enlightened and well-informed program. A simple question: why didn't we do that from the beginning?
Yeah. Is that a real question?
It's a real question. It's not a rhetorical. Now,
well,
if you allow me, General,
mm-hmm.
The United States is a superpower, and no doubt in the future there might be other situations in which it might get involved. Will they have to reinvent the wheel again?
Let me first say that the reason that detention was managed the way it was until I got there in May is because it was run by a manual. And the manual, the doctrine, was completely compliant. It was inspected by the International Red Cross, inspected by the Army, the Inspector Generals, all came through. They were absolutely passing what the doctrine said. So why is it that the detainees were running the inside, that they were in charge of recruiting, intimidation, preparation, organizing? Why is it that happened? And the answer is because you don't define the enemy in the same way, and you don't rely on the same tactics and techniques that you had before if you don't assess the problem correctly. And so the simple answer is former leadership didn't assess the problem correctly. It's just the simple answer. Now, this is not me talking about me, but this is my boss talking about me. I assessed the problem correctly. I've dealt with it. It's not perfect. It'll have to adapt and have to keep going forward. But what has come out of this is everything, the theory behind it, the development of it, the process, the principles, all of these things have been developed by us, by me, by the team, in the construct of doing this. Why is Buka down, within spitting distance of Unkasar, 800 meters away from Kuwait? In part because it might be an EPW model. The Korean War guys will remember Koji Do was on an island. They stepped him out there. Just as one point, and I could talk for hours on this, but just for one point, in this case, we need the families. If we don't have the families, we can't make the reintegration happen. You know this. The Saudis and others know this in their programs. The Yemenis know it in their programs. So why didn't we know, instead of bringing the families in, when armed escorts should have been given to the families to bring them in? Instead, they were coming down from, pick your favorite place, Mosul, Al-Anbar, fighting. Well, it takes us hours to fly down there. I don't know how many days it took for those families to go down or what they suffered to get down to visit their loved ones. Even bad guys, forget it. The loved ones, their families, it's a perfectly appropriate right they have to do that. Why were they down there? Why was that camp way down there? Why is it still there? The answer is we're building Taj Ramadi to push it all forward. But, because we were fighting a different war with a different enemy, and that's why. These are good people who are doing the right thing, but it just takes a different way to look at the problem. And I have suffered nose everywhere. and I'm the first one to say it, I've said it publicly, the only guy that has said yes has been General Petraeus. Sometimes every single effort has been made to block these programs. I mean, you got biases inside here. It's day in, day out. I mean, my guys can tell you. Talk to any of these campuses. They will tell you, if there's one thing that we do, it is we ignore everybody else, and we just go forward. I've got more investigations against me than any general you know. I mean, it makes... I can't tell you. I mean, to put in the day school for the youth is in the red zone. It's night next to Camp Victory. I asked for it, and you can't do it because of the things that we did. We just took bulldozers and went through the goddamn wall. And then we said, shit, there's a break in the wall, give me a bunch of T-walls. And then with the T-walls around, and we have a day school for kids, it's perfect, never been a problem. Lots of investigations, but what the hell? And that's just one of hundreds of those kinds of things.
General, I see your aides moving into position to whisk you out of here, but I do want to take just 10 seconds to say I think we're all grateful for your efforts to fix something that was very broken.
Thank you.
Yeah.